Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
This, my dear Glaucon, is a time of great danger for a person. And to prepare for it, we must be extremely careful, putting aside every other pursuit and focusing on how to distinguish among good and bad lives, and finding teachers who can foster that ability. Well, that might be a caution for us in these days, a time of great danger for a person. Terror and terrorism are the words of the day. We are like a country under bombardment. Our psyches prepare us to run for our lives while our heads tell us there is nowhere to run to. We do not have to be told that this is a time of great danger for a person. But then what time has not been a time of great danger? Was there ever a time, ever a prolonged time of freedom from anxiety, from fear, from real danger? I came across a remarkable passage from a speech the Venerable Senator Robert Byrd made some years ago. Remarkable, I thought, for its relevance for today. In an address to Congress, Senator Byrd said, "People are being warned of imminent terrorist attacks with little guidance as to when or where such attacks might occur. Family members are being called to active duty with no idea of the durability of their stay or what horrors they may face. The mood of the nation is deep." My opening quote comes, in fact, from long ago and far away. It is ostensibly part of a dialogue between Plato and Glaucon, Plato's older brother. Both brothers were students in Socrates' esteemed circle. And Plato, often acting as the spokesperson for Socrates, his teacher and mentor, in a massive work known as The Republic, written about 2,500 years ago. After all those millennia, there are still something like 2,500 scholars at last count committing their academic lives to the continuing analysis and interpretation of the Republic. In many cases, one line. Only slightly fewer than those devoting their lives to a letter-by-letter analysis of the Christian or Hebrew scriptures. And there's good reason for continuing to attend to Plato. Even this short excerpt from the last pages of the last book of the Republic still has the ring of urgency to it. The Republic is a huge, often dense, complicated work. I'd like you to think that I have read it from cover to cover, but you wouldn't believe me. But the question at the center of the work is fundamental. The question is whether it is better to live justly, that is to live good lives, or unjustly, to live bad lives. Obviously, it is better to love justly, is it not? Well, you and I know it isn't that simple. As the Apostle Paul says in those Christian scriptures, the good that I would do, that I do not. The evil that I would not do, that I do. And Plato, like so many of the early philosophers, and the later for that matter, knew well that while we are rational beings, most of us are ruled more often by our passions and our desires than we are by reason. We may try to be good in thought and deed, but it doesn't take much to trip us up and send us falling happily and gratefully into our failures. Nothing is more satisfactory than satisfactory self-justification. At the very best, we are in a constant struggle among such conflicting promptings as what reason tells us is good, what our desires tell us we must have to be happy, and what conscience tells us we could get away with. The Apostle Paul again said, the good that I would do, that I do not, the evil I would not do, that I do. Plato used a rushing chariot as a metaphor for our human condition, with two horses representing the passions, one wild horse with base passions, the other with noble passions, each tugging against the other, determined to have its way, and the chariot driver, reason, attempting to balance them one against the other so that some headway might be made. It's significant that Plato says that this is a dangerous time for a person. He does not say it is a dangerous time for the world or humankind, although, of course, it is. And he doesn't say it is a difficult time for the nation, though, of course, it is. He says it is a difficult time for a person. It is the person that most interested Plato, because in all of his massive work about the ideal republic, Plato's republic is actually a metaphor for the human soul. It's the soul that interested Plato, because as the soul goes, so goes the nation. And it is the human soul that Plato believed to be in danger in dangerous times. If we do not live good lives, if we are not just, if we do not choose the good, it is the human soul that suffers disorder and decay. Now, Plato, of course, believed in a literal human soul, an actual entity, an entity engaged with other ideal forms he believed existed in the universe. We may not believe that we have souls literally, as actual entities infused at birth, slipping away like a formless mist at death, like those miserable beings floating past Scrooge's window. I do believe, however, that there is a ground of our being. I believe we have what the theologian Henry Nelson Wyman called an authentic existence, a true self, often buried deep beneath a lifetime of self-deception and social adaptation. Wordsworth, speaking of our birth, wrote that we come trailing clouds of glory. Now, of course, eventually most of that glory wears off. But in most of us, though weakened, there abides within us still the source of our best intentions, our inclination toward the good, our capacity for love and compassion and empathy. But these are times of great danger for our souls. And says Plato, we must be very careful, putting aside every other pursuit and focusing on how to distinguish among good lives and bad lives. Always being sure to choose the better life to the extent that that is possible. Ah, there's the rub. To the extent that that is possible. How do we distinguish between the good and the bad? We are so enamored of skepticism, relativism, sophistry, and our wish to not know what the good is. I mean, what's a little thievery if it's not too much and nobody notices? What's a small lie here or there if it gets you what you want and nobody's the wiser? What's a little muffling of our own inner cries for truth? What's a small mortgage on the soul? We won't do it again. Not much. Not often. Hey, you know, I'm really good at heart. Well, these are times, dangerous times for a person. As Tom Paine said, these are the times that try men's souls. These are times dangerous to our souls because times of fear, anxiety, of uncertainty, these are the times in which we are most likely to turn from the good to the convenient, from what is right to what calms our unease, from truth to whatever uplifts our despair. And those choices for the bad against the good silently shred our souls and diminish us. How can we choose? How can we know what is good? Some believe that intuition of the right to do good is implanted in humankind by God. Emerson believed that we know justice intuitively because justice, he believed, is inherent in nature and we are part of nature. Philosopher Immanuel Kant said he was sure of two things, the starry heavens above and the moral law within. For Kant, the right thing to do is a given. He was as sure of the reality of the truth within us, as sure of the innate laws of the good that are absolute and immutable as he was of the stars in the heavens. In the Hebrew scriptures, in the book of the prophet Micah, it is written, he has shown you what is good. And what does God require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Note that Micah says that God has shown us what is good, meaning that as Kant insisted, knowledge of the good is innate, intuitive, part of our nature. No excuses from the prophets. We know what the good is. Given a reasonable degree of sanity, we know what the good is and cannot fool God, ourselves, or Mother Nature. And note, too, that among God's simple essential requirements, the first is to do justice. The first requirement of what is absolute in the universe is that we do the right thing. All this is to say that unless the soul is dead, unless the mind is warped by illness, by existential exhaustion, or simply by the world, the knowledge of what is good and what is bad is within us, and we can choose. By considering all these things, Plato said, we will be able to determine which is the better and which is the worse life. And he said, when the time comes to choose, we will be able to call bad the kind of life that would make our soul unjust, and the good that will make it more just. This, Plato said, is the way of genuine happiness for the human being. It comes down finally to that. We know in our hearts, we know within intuitively, we know what the good is, and if we choose the good, we will do justice, which is all that is required of us. And if we are just, we will do what is good, we will be happy, for doing good is what happiness is. So, all this is open to stunning and robust critique. And laughter, of course. All very humorous, all this knowing deep inside what the good is. It is stuff so easy to muddle that philosophy students can sound wise beyond their years simply by muttering with each other about such things as determinism and enlightened self-interest. But I believe Kant. I believe Ralph Waldo Emerson. I believe Plato and Micah the prophet, scorned as they all may be. And more importantly, I believe myself. I believe myself when I remind myself from time to time that I do know what is right and what is just, and choose to go with what I know or not. Plato also admonishes us to attend to another source of knowledge of what is good and what is bad. He says we should focus on how to distinguish among good and bad lives and find teachers who can foster that ability. I say again, he says we should focus on how to distinguish among good and bad lives by finding teachers who can foster this ability. Find the teachers who can help us distinguish the good from the bad, the just from the unjust. To what extent do our teachers transform us? And to what extent do we choose our teachers out of whom we truly are? We are known by our heroes, by those persons we proclaim as great, as truth tellers. The student is known by those at whose feet she or he sits. Think about it. Who taught you what is good and what is bad. Who were they? Who taught you what is the right thing to do? Were their teachings good? Have they stood the test of time and your experience? Who are your teachers now? And no matter my age or yours, we still have them. To whom do you turn? In books, in persons, through other media? To whom do you turn when you need help in knowing what is good in these times? I can still remember the first teacher who touched my soul. The young woman, I know now she was a young woman at the time, who took us little children of her class through the bombed up streets, our hands held tightly together, to the opera, or to watch a play, or a pantomime, to go to a concert, who read poetry to us, often through tears, as I later learned, tears that were shed for her husband, who had been a Spitfire pilot lost somewhere over the channel. Her name, still blessed after all these decades, was Nora Amstey. And some years later, there was the widow of a school superintendent who took it upon herself to be my tutor when I was in danger of flunking out of high school. Now, she lived, I don't know why, but she lived in two rooms over the shops on the main street of our town, rooms that smelled exotically of her Persian cigarettes, of old books and stacked albums of 78 RPM records. She brought my Latin up to snuff, and my English and my history. We listened to poetry. I remember the recorded voices of T.S. Eliot and Dylan Thomas. Poetry, she said, was good poetry. I listened until my own soul proclaimed it good. Her name, blessed be, was Mrs. Perry. I don't know her first name. I don't think it was ever mentioned, and she would have considered it highly impertinent to be asked. In later years, there have been teachers who sent me out into the desert to learn from all life there. There is very little in the desert that is lifeless. To learn from the eagles, the slithering creatures, the sly coyote, and the white-tailed deer. I went to those teachers to be reminded when I began to forget, when I began to be deceived again. I went to be reminded of what my soul knew to be good, while my body will no longer carry me to the mountains, my spirit bears me there still. There are many heroes still and many teachers, and there is much we need to know and how much of which we need to be reminded. This is a time of great danger for a person, and to prepare for it, we must be extremely careful, putting aside every pursuit and focusing on how to distinguish among good and bad lives, and finding teachers who can focus and foster that ability. And these are times that try men's souls. Pain meant try in terms of testing our mettle, seeing what we are made of, fear, anxiety, uncertainty, the times are made of this. And we must know what we have made our own, what we know to be good and strong and certain within us. These are the times to look within, to look into our souls, to look into the authentic self, the self that is mostly, most often, undeceived. It was Socrates, the teacher, who said the unexamined life is not worth living. How far have we strayed from what we once knew to be the good, the true, and the beautiful within us? Now is the time to ask. In times that may foreshadow the worst, this ancient teacher from an ancient time urges us to face it with the best, urges us to make choices as we once did, urges us to seek teachers as we once did, to stir once again that ability to know the good and to do it. In this, we shall be good citizens of the Republic. In this, we shall grow good souls which will resist tyranny, ignorance, and other evils. I want to end this sermon with a benediction from the Talmud that you have heard me give. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justice now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You are not obligated to complete the work, nor are you permitted to abandon it. Amen.